Monster House presents.
Monster Talk is an independent podcast production of Monster House, LLC. You can show your support by subscribing to our ad-free extended episodes at patreon.com/monstertalk. We want to grow our Monster Talk audience, and the easiest way to accomplish that is for listeners to leave us 5-star reviews on iTunes. Positive reviews have a huge impact and only take a moment.
It's actually quite unlike anything we've ever seen before.
A giant, hairy creature, part ape, part man.
In Loch Ness, a 24-mile-long bottomless lake in the highlands of Scotland, it's a creature known as the Loch Ness Monster.
Monster Talk.
Good grief, 2020 is a weird year. It's like the whole world got that fortune cookie that reads, "May you live in interesting times." Karen and I are hoping that you're managing to stay safe and healthy and are finding the resources you need if you're struggling. Hang in there. It's hard for me to believe it myself sometimes, but things will get better. This is a fun interview Karen and I managed to get with a Canadian professor who's decided to start doing research on ghosts from within the academic field of sociology. He's just getting started, but listener Patty Mascaro alerted us to his research, and we were delighted to sit down with him to discuss it. We've been continuing to record our Sunday evening Monster Talk Live episodes, which you can check out at youtube.com/Monster Talk Podcast. And I have been terrible at getting them into the regular feed, and I apologize for that. It's not out of laziness, just a lack of enough hours. But I am working on some personal time management steps that should let me squeeze a few more hours out of each week. Thank you so much for your support and your patience. By the way, please take a moment if you have time and subscribe to our YouTube feed. We're trying to get to 1,000 subscribers, and we have some more fun video content that we started working on. Your liking and subscribing to our feed is a big help. Also, another apology, my audio in this episode is weird and sounds like I'm broadcasting from an AM radio in some yellow 1973 Delta 88. I apologize. I'm sorry about that. I do have some great audio equipment, but I had to use inferior gear for this one, and sadly it sounds far worse in the recorded form than it did during the call. It's easy enough to understand all the words, but I understand that it will annoy some of our audiophile listeners. A special thanks to Sean Park for helping edit this episode. Okay, let's get on to some
Monster Talk.
All right, welcome to Monster Talk. Today we're talking with Dr. David Aveline, Associate Professor of Sociology at the Mount Royal University. Is it Mount Royal or Mount Royal?
Mount Royal.
Mount Royal University.
No E.
There's no E.
On this side of Canada.
In deference to other pronouncements. All right. The Associate Professor of Sociology at the Mount Royal University in Calgary, Alberta, Canada. Now, I know that you are studying sociology and teaching sociology, and that at least some part of that is the study of monsters and the paranormal. I mean, that falls within sociology to some extent.
It can, yes.
It can, okay. Right. It's certainly not a key focus, but I know over the course of 10 years of doing the show, we've run into a lot of sociologists who are interested in that aspect of human behavior. But how did you come to get involved in the sort of paranormal side of this research?
Well, I don't know. Bit of a mystery to me because I got my PhD when I was 50, which is almost 20 years ago. And, you know, I was studying, I majored in human sexuality. So I was studying human sexuality for 15 years or so. And I kind of got tired of that, so I was looking for something new. But I've always been interested in paranormal beliefs. So I just, you know, put sexuality on the shelf entirely and went out, got a small grant, and then traveled across Canada in 4 major cities interviewing people who believe they have seen ghosts. Now, I will say that I come from the point of view of a skeptic, right? That I like evidence. If I'm going to define things as real, then I like to see evidence of it. But that really is irrelevant, because it's not whether I believe in ghosts, it's whether they believe in ghosts. And, you know, there's a 1920s sociologist named W.Y. Thomas, and he says that if things are defined as real, they are real in their consequences. So I basically found a lot of people who sincerely believe that they have seen a ghost, being touched by a ghost, smelled a ghost, heard a ghost, you know, everything but tasted a ghost, if we're looking at the five senses, right? You know, and a lot of people, you know, they are real in their consequences to them, because a lot of people are troubled. Some people are even comforted, the fact that the ghost of their dead husband, you know, appeared in a window to say goodbye to them. Or, you know, in another case, there was two, a brother and a sister-in-law, and they appeared in two windows on the bedroom bedroom wall to say that they're all right. You know, but a lot of people, you know, live with ghosts. You know, they see them every day. And everything, and I found this rather fascinating. But you know, from a skeptic's point of view, I went to this rather naively. That I said to myself, well, you know, the existence of ghosts is irrelevant. It matters whether they believe them or not. But you know, people were telling me things, and my mind was immediately going towards logical explanations. For example, somebody said, I woke up in the middle of the night and I had a feeling of somebody holding me down, and then my coat turned into a little girl that came toward me. So when I heard that, I immediately thought of, you know, sleep paralysis, night terrors, parasomnia, and this sort of thing. But when I did this, I felt rather guilty. You know, I sort of questioned myself and said, you know, who am I? Who am I to sort of say what was really going on here, especially when I wasn't there? But I felt that, you know, my private thoughts were betraying the people I was talking to. So what I did was I just tried to put that aside completely, bracket it off, and, you know, listen to what the people were telling me about their beliefs. That went to step two. You know, that was all right when you could bracket off logical explanations, but there were some stories that there are no logical explanations to bracket off. People were telling me things that, you know, to me were against the laws of physics, physically impossible, against the laws of nature. One person told me that he called out a ghost from behind the bed. And the ghost appeared and he said, you must go. And the ghost shook his head no. But then he prayed to the angel Gabriel, and the angel Gabriel, who was 10 feet tall, came down, talked to him and convinced him to go. He descended from the ceiling, then wrapped him in his wings and took him up through the ceiling again in a cloud of smoke. And so, you know, that was one story that I heard. And you know, I'm thinking, you know, okay, I'm going to bracket off logical explanations, but here there's absolutely no logical explanations to, you know, bracket off. It's absolutely fantastic story. And, you know, these are very sincere people. Most of the people, actually the majority of people I talked to had some college, and 14 out of 38 of them had a college degree or higher. I spoke to a doctor, a police officer, a nurse, a journalist. You know, and these are people who have been trained in empirical observation as well. So it's not as if, you know, as if people were, you know, telling me funny stories or something for their own amusement. You know, they sincerely believed what they were saying.
Yeah, actually, you know, we've been doing Monster Talk for about 10 years. And I think when we started out, we probably were a little closer to trying to debunk some of the classic stories, or, you know, find out more about what was going on. But over the course of that time, we've come to have a lot of empathy for people reporting the weird, because, as you say, a lot of these stories can't really be disproven or proven. They're just anecdotes in a sense, but you start to have a lot of empathy for people, because whether they're real or not, these are experiences the humans are having, and as we're all humans, having empathy, I think, and trying to understand how these stories influence their lives has been really important to I guess a shift in how we cover the material. You know, I think reducing fear is important. Like,
yes,
a lot of the stories we look at, we want people to know, don't worry about this so much, you know. But some of the things people experience can be quite terrifying.
Yeah, you know, surprisingly, many people told me that they weren't scared. You know, and I'm thinking, well, you know, if a ghost appeared in my bedroom in the middle of the night, you know, I would be on the ceiling, you know, if that happened. Seriously, but they weren't scared. They were comforted. You know, sometimes it was a grandmother sitting on the edge of the bed or a mother, very often a relative. But the important thing is, as you know, as you say, Blake, they sincerely believe that these experiences are real. And that's really all that matters to me in that sense, right? You know, I mean, I'm not going out trying to debunk things like, like somebody in the, you know, in Victorian era looking at mesmerists and things like that, or table rappers. I'm just a sociologist looking at people's beliefs. And it opened my eyes. It opened my eyes that there were some fantastic beliefs out there. It's quite amazing, and I'm sure you could educate me on that.
Well, I think David, in the past 10 minutes, you have answered every single question that we've written already.
All right. Well, what are we talking about
now? But we'll go into further detail and just drill down further into some of these topics. And you've spoken about some of the categories or types of paranormal encounters that people have reported. Why do you think these experiences are common? You know, why is it that you see time and time again that people have had these bereavement hallucinations where someone, a loved one, has died, and then they see that person, a manifestation of them, or out of the corner of their eye, or something like that. And then other people see demons, or other people see shadow people. Why do you think that these experiences are common?
I would love to blame the absolute explosion of paranormal media phenomena these days. You know, if you try and count the number of ghost hunting shows on television, there seem to be like 12, 18, 20 going at the same time. And it's, you know, it's amazing, ghost hunters. Also, I think that ghost stories have been around in folklore for thousands of years. But I think the main thing is that, you know, we are trusting of our own personal experience. Now, you know, if you're looking at empiricism says that we're not going to have confidence in anything unless we can reproduce it. If I see a ghost, that's very nice, but unless I can have you come there and see the same ghost and then have a bunch of other people, then it becomes anecdotal, right? People trust their own experience. I did ask people, for example, you know that science says ghosts exist. How do you answer that? And most of the answers, you know, were something to the nature of, well, they have their opinion and I have mine. You know, I've seen the ghost, therefore the ghost is real. And I think, again, it's trust in one's, you know, in one's own perceptions. But at the same time, a lot of people said, I saw the ghost in my mind. I saw the ghost out of the corner of my eye. A lot of corner of my eye sightings, for example. You know, more so corner of eye than full-on sightings. You know, there it is right in front of me. But, you know, I think, well, first of all, we trust our own perceptions, but you know, very often our perceptions are biased to, you know, to our own biographies and our own beliefs and this sort of thing. I mean, one of the million-dollar questions is why do people believe in God when, you know, there's no empirical evidence? I don't know if that will get me in trouble. You know, the answer,
you'll find out when you die, I think. Is that
the answer to that is faith, right?
When I was reading about your study, I think I read, and correct me if I'm wrong, that part of what you're doing right now is trying to classify the stories. What kind of, if that's right, what kind of classifications are you looking at?
Well, right now I'm in the coding phase, which means I read the interviews And every time something relevant comes out, like, you know, appearance, you know, I will code appearance. So I don't know if I have an answer to that yet, but, you know, I will, you know, I will come out with it.
Are you looking at something like a folklore motif kind of coding? Is that, or like, are you looking for like full bodied apparition versus, you know,
oh, yes,
a sensation or, you know?
I mean, that's the quantitative part of it. You know, how many ghosts were male? How many were female? How many were relatives? How many were strangers? How many were attached to a house? And how many just sort of were floating around, sort of thing? Why were they here? What was the reason of it? You know, and that those are the sort of questions I'm looking at right now. But it's sort of like, you know, I have 38 interviews, several hundred pages. And it's a giant jigsaw puzzle. So I'm taking them and sorting them into all sorts of categories here. Well, one of them is counting the number of ghosts. And I think I've got about 300 ghosts. And that comes from 38 interviews and 24 stories that were sent to me through email. You know, people that could be interviewed. So, you know, there's quite a few ghosts. And some of them, like, some, you know, one guy saw a man walking around with his head, you know, a dead soldier, for example. A lot of children, I found, children who don't know they're dead and they want to play. These are ghosts, you know, that want to play. And when you don't want to play with them, they get mad. A lot of pets, you know, your beloved cat or your beloved dog. And surprisingly, a lot of people have said that pets, your dog, is going to sense the ghost before you do. You know, so you'd be sitting on the couch, and then suddenly, roof, roof, roof. You know, and dog is like looking at the foot of the stairs, for example, and then suddenly, an apparition appears later. So that's quite eerie.
Oh, it is. I had a haunting experience myself before I became a hardcore skeptic, and one of the things I did was got a dog because I knew from folklore that dogs could see the paranormal. And now I've come to believe that pets are idiots, but that's a big transition.
So with your subjects, did you find that they were reluctant to share their stories, that they thought that you wouldn't believe them or that other people had not believed their stories in the past?
There were a few statements like, "You must think I'm a crazy person telling you this." But, you know, generally, I mean, first of all, I was very impressed with the people, you know, a police officer, a doctor, a journalist. You know, these were very, very rational people sitting down in various places, usually a coffee shop, you know, with my tape recorder on. You know, but I found that they were very anxious to talk to me. Finally, somebody is looking at this sort of stuff. You know, some of them said, "I got people mostly through Craigslist." I know Craigslist has a bad reputation for various reasons, but you know, in the volunteer section, for example, you know, if you put ads in there looking for people to interview, that's how I got a lot of people in that way. But they were, you know, "Oh my God, you know, finally somebody is looking at this. Do I have a story for you?" And there are people who had experienced ghosts since they were 4 years old, right down to a couple of people that, you know, one man in his 50s, never seen a ghost before. Suddenly there is one, you know, right in front of him, even talking to him. You know, and so that's interesting. People all their lives, and then people like once and never again, kind of thing. Those once and never again experiences, I think, are quite interesting.
Well, I noticed you said that like you had interviewed how many people? 34, and then 38, and then you got more than 20 additional write-ins. But from that you got more than 300 ghosts reported. That's
yes.
So like I don't know what that is. Polyapparitional? It's like it seems like some people get no ghosts and some people get more than their fair share.
Well, I you know, not only talk to, shall we say, regular people, but I also talk to, there are 8 people who define themselves as what they call sensitives. You know, that they have the ability to sense these things. And, you know, I would say, well, geez, you're lucky. I don't have them. And the answer is, well, you have to open your mind, kind of thing. Sensitives, a couple of spiritual leaders, indigenous spiritual leaders, and a paranormal investigation group. I interviewed one city. So I got the gamut of it. One clairvoyant who made her living from her ability to see ghosts and people and everything else. But what was the question?
Oh, I was just wondering, like, why such a small population would have such an excessive amount of reporting, and I wonder if that says something about. Well, as you say, if they say they're sensitive,
and propensity to believing.
I've had some weird experiences myself, but
me too. And we've always explained away, we look at the paranormal as more of a perspective. If you are a believer, you can have paranormal-like experiences, but if you're a believer, you're going to interpret those as being paranormal. If you're more skeptically inclined, then you're going to look for natural explanations for what's happened.
Blue dress, gold dress.
Well, an example of that, when I was 24, my grandmother died. She was in the hospital, and I remember, you know, feeling very cold in my bed, like a sudden, the temperature dropped in the room, and then there was the phone call to tell us that she died. Now, that can be interpreted in many ways. If I were a believer, I would, I would interpret that as, you know, she has, passing by to say goodbye, for example. But as a non-believer, I've just interpreted as, changes in my body for some reason because I was stressed. We can look at it both ways, depending upon our beliefs, if you like.
Yeah, we do a lot of work around, like, reading about memory and how memories change over time, too. And I know even from my own experience, I think about 10 years after my experiences, I wrote them down. And then about 10 years later, I went back and revisited it. And even then, my memories had changed. I mean, there was still the core was there. But the order in which things happened had changed. Lots of little details had morphed over time. It's just really hard to keep an accurate memory. Memory's not what's constantly being reformed.
Exactly.
I think there's a question in that too. Were a lot of these stories recent, or were these experiences that had taken place some time ago, or was it just a mix and combination of both?
Both. There were several people. Couldn't tell you how many, but quite a few. Who always remembered that they had seen ghosts. Now, it's interesting, you know, the typical story I heard was, you know, I was 4 years old and I was sitting in the closet and a man was sitting beside me. And I thought, okay, and I started talking to him and he talked back and that sort of thing. But if you're 4 years old, you don't say, you know, holy crap, there's a man beside me. You know, you just sort of accept your environment as a given, because you don't know the difference between reality and non-reality. So, you know, some people have had it all their lives, and again, one time only. The ones who had had it all their lives, some of them did mention that their parents also believed in ghosts and had seen ghosts, and they had been raised with ghosts in the house, you know, if they lived in an old farmhouse in Ontario or something like that, you know. So, I think background makes quite a difference.
Right. Yeah. So you think that there's a kind of socialization aspect where if someone's raised in maybe a religious household or
yes.
a household of believers, that's going to affect them possibly for their whole lives.
Exactly.
Although that's actually, this reminds me a little bit of the Bigfoot Field Research Organization, the BFRO, has a huge database of people reporting Bigfoot stories.
Oh, I'd love to talk to Bigfoot sighted people.
Yeah, like, yeah.
No, next project.
Yeah. Well,
yes, wonderful. Next project. Yes.
Well, the interesting thing about that, their database is, as a person who works with data for my day job, I find it problematic. Like there's classifications of, you know, how it, almost like the Close Encounters, the first kind, second kind, third kind, that kind of way. But there's also the factor that some of the most impressive sightings happened the furthest back in time from when they were reported.
Uh-huh.
And that dimension of how long ago these experiences happened make them almost impossible to go research. You can't go back and recreate that moment because it wasn't last week. It was 3 decades ago.
Right.
Well, 2 people, as I was interviewing them, saw a ghost as I was interviewing them.
As you were in, while you were talking to them?
While we were talking, one said, there's a man behind you. You know, this isn't a coffee shop. I looked around. I couldn't see a man. I said, well, I can't see him. He's there. He's wearing a black hat. Nobody there. Okay, and this one person defined herself as a sensitive. Another person told me that there is an angel hovering around on my left shoulder, and that she has always been there, and I couldn't see as well. So, but getting back to time, I think if you can really relate the story that happened 10, 12 years ago, it must have left a very deep impression on you that you have never forgotten it. There's probably a distortion over time, but at the same time, it's imprinted on the memory because it's not forgotten and it's somehow considered a significant experience. I was told, by the way, that I'm going to live to 88 years old, so that put a spring in my step.
Nice.
I've got another 20 years to go. So.
Fantastic. Well, you know, I don't want to say that. Just because the memories aren't reliable that they never happened, because that's not what I mean. I just mean that the significance can be there, the importance can be there, but the details can change. And if there's nothing more to the story than I saw this person or I saw this figure, you know, maybe it doesn't matter if the memories are fairly mutable. I mean, it's not like you get to falsify the story because they said there was a hat and now there's no hat when they retell it 20 years later. You know what I mean? Like the details are going to be malleable in any story.
Mm-hmm.
Exactly.
But I think we do, you know, we do like to find out, if possible, whether there's anything to the ghosts. Like, do the ghosts only come from us, or do the ghosts have some real, you know, corporeal or like some basis in reality, you know? Yeah, that's interesting.
That's an interesting philosophical question. It reminds me of, like, first of all, where do the ghosts come from? And a lot of people talk about the veil. Now, what is the veil? You know, it almost seems like it's a curtain somewhere that you go in and out of, that sort of thing. But, it doesn't seem to have a definite place or anything else. It's just sort of something that exists over and above us in supernature that you go through and you don't go or you don't go through, like a different dimension kind of thing. I like your question, though, do the ghosts come from us, or do they exist sui generis by themselves? I think they would certainly come from us, come from our experiences. But, we interpret our experiences in numerous different ways. If I got bumps in the night in my house, I might define it as, oh, damn, I need to call a plumber. Other people might be terribly scared that there's a ghost in their house. Is a matter of background, is a matter of the way we process information. Perhaps it's a matter of wishful thinking. It depends. There's just so many factors there. Ultimately, since we are the interpreters of our own experience, the ghost would come from us.
And I should mention at this point, too, that one of our listeners actually introduced us to you, and that's Patty Mascaro. I believe she's a colleague of yours from the university.
Yes, exactly. Yes.
And she...
But I'm very grateful to her.
Yes, yes, we're very grateful too. And she sent us an article in which you'd been interviewed by the university about your work. One of the things that you'd said is that you wanted to find out what people believe and also how that affects their lives. So how did these paranormal experiences affect people's lives, and why is this important for them?
In all sorts of ways. First of all, looking at the sensitives, there were a couple of them, that, actually three or four of them, that said things to the nature of, this is really unpleasant. I wish I didn't have it. One person said that he feels pain when people die, before they die. So he knows that somebody is going to die somewhere. Another person said, I can't be in public. I'm on the bus. And I can feel everybody's emotions.
Wow.
I can feel, yeah.
Well, that must be, this is the luckiest time for them in the world. They can't be out.
Yeah, I've absolutely heard of stories like this before, with people talking about, when I'm around other people, I can feel the headache that the person next to me has, or if someone's got a cold, I can sense that. So yeah, I've definitely heard of these empath types.
Well, and you have empathy towards, or you have that empathic response to parasite stories. So if I started talking about mites digging under my skin, why, I bet you'd start itching, right?
Getting itchy. Thank you. Maybe it's being psychosomatic.
Yeah.
A couple of stories about, if you're a sensitive, you can't be in a, they said, well, I can't be in a hospital. Why? Because, thousands and thousands of people have died at a hospital, especially if it's like 100 years old. And I can feel the energy. Energy was a big word for a lot of people. They didn't actually see a ghost, but they walked into a room and, oh my God, this is just really bad energy. And I had to get out of there. I couldn't stay in this room because there was bad energy. So that happened quite a bit.
That's really interesting to me. Physics has a meaning for energy that's very specific.
Yes.
And it's really easy for skeptics to get really smug and say, well, that's not what energy means. Energy means this other thing. But mm-hmm. I think as someone who has, I was a teenager once. I had dates. And I remember what it was like to date someone who sucked the energy out of your life. And so when I hear people talk about psychic vampires and that sort of thing, I don't think they're paranormal, but I know what they mean. Like, I'm very sympathetic to the idea that there's a concept of energy. Yeah.
There's definitely a layperson sense of energy and all of these other terms too, even like vibrations. A lot of those terms have just been have evolved different meanings and usage just among the public.
There's a colloquial meaning which is real enough, and that vibe, whether it's a psychic, impact, without granting the existence of psychic powers, I am aware that there's a dimension of human psychology where you are impacted by place and by circumstance.
Yeah.
So I just want to throw that out there because skeptics get a bad rap for being reductionist. And I don't think we all are. So.
Yeah, I know. Actually, I just wrote that down. What is energy? ? They're not meaning it in the physics sense.
Right, right.
Something that you can measure. Although, there are devices that paranormal investigators use. I forgot the name of them.
we're very well versed in those things, like EMF readers and K2 meters, and we've done a lot of shows on ghost hunting.
Yes. Okay. There we go. Exactly.
Our listeners will know what you're talking about. Yeah, we've come to the conclusion, I think, that those devices don't translate to actually recognize the sort of colloquial version, right? So the feelings of energy or whatever that is that you feel when you walk into a, like going into an old asylum, for example, You know, yeah, there's something to that, and you can preload it with stories.
A mood or a sense or some kind of
you can be primed with stories.
That people get.
Yeah, there's so much going on there, but that's not going to show up on any meter.
Another interesting thing is that I've come across three people that met a person and thought this person was a real person, but this person then turned out to be a ghost. I don't know how well you know this part of Canada, but there's this wonderful place about 80 miles from here called Banff. And Banff is like this wonderful wilderness with this old grand hotel. And in there, there's quite a famous ghost called Jimmy the Bellhop. And he appears sometimes, but one guy told me he was in an elevator in this Banff Springs Hotel. And, you know, there was a small, decrepit old bellhop who was running the elevator. And he was insulting and everything. And then he just got out of the elevator at the next floor, turned around and disappeared. And the man followed him out, and there were no doors or anything for him to have gone through. He just turned left and he was gone. Another woman saw, you know, met two men. Both took her. They took her in each hand. They took each of her hands side by side. Told her she was a wonderful person, and then turned around the corner and disappeared again. That's really interesting that you see real people who are actually ghosts. You know, it's perhaps there might be a logical explanation for them. You know, maybe.
That's the Banff Springs Hotel, B-A-N-F-F. Is that where?
Yeah.
Yeah, that is a gorgeous place. I've always wanted to go there.
Me too.
Yeah,
yes.
It's so spectacular. It looks very gothic.
Oh, it does. You know, come up here and I'll show you around.
Well, that's my end game, man. Get to Canada.
With the Jimmy the Bellhop story, was there any follow up to that? Because that was sounding a little bit to me like an urban legend that we've spoken about before, the Lord Dufferin story.
Mm-hmm. Like, quite similar, yeah.
I did actually call the hotel, and haven't gotten around to going visiting them yet, talking about it. But you know, they do say yes, it's stories, and a lot of guests over the years have said that they've seen him. There's another hotel where I won't say the city; it's in Canada. There's the Bride. You know, and she basically goes around and she comes back once a year on the anniversary of the day her husband was shot 100 years ago. People have seen her. And there's one room that people have come screaming out of. But at the same time, you got to figure it's to the advantage of a hotel to play up its own ghost stories, right? Because that's your business.
We've been counting that a lot.
Yeah. I'm in that city. I'm going to ask for that room.
Oh yeah, right. I think my experience staying at the Stanley was they were definitely leaning in on the paranormal stuff, and that's the hotel that was the basis of The Shining.
Oh right.
Oh
exactly.
Yeah, they definitely do not like skeptics. My husband does similar work to me, and he was banished or basically not allowed to come back to the hotel because he'd debunked some of the stories that had taken place there. Ghost hunters had gone there and had a number of things apparently happen to them. And so he explained what could have possibly happened. Well, he actually had had it on information from the actual people who were there that these were just tricks and these were just naturally occurring things. And they said, please don't come back.
Wait a minute. So if I go to check in at the Stanley, they'll first, if they find out I'm a skeptic, they'll do a banish check?
Oh, yeah.
Well,
sounds like a private joke.
Because, you know, they will weed out what's supposedly real or what can't be disproven and what can be disproven. Mm-hmm. I don't know, but next time I'm in that city, I will go to that hotel and I'll ask for that room. But I won't stay alone. I don't think.
I'm not too far from the Stanley, so we'll have to catch up if you come to Colorado.
Where is the Stanley? Is it in Colorado?
Yeah, Estes Park. Yeah.
Estes Park. So it's about an hour and a half away from Denver.
Oh, lovely, lovely.
Such a beautiful little valley. It is so pretty. And it's right at the entrance to the sort of Rocky Mountain Park.
But you'd probably have to book about 2 or 3 years ahead to get the haunted rooms there.
Yeah.
And they're very expensive, about $500 a night.
Well, we can climb Brokeback Mountain, filmed about 30 miles out of Calgary.
The ghosts in the regular rooms are not as posh, I guess. That's
Yeah, exactly.
But, you know, there was a story of a government official that was in there, quite high up, not the prime minister, but somebody else, and they ran out of the room screaming, as it were. So I don't know. As I say, you know, I mean, if I did see a ghost, I would believe. It's as simple as that. But otherwise, I think I've quite successfully taken the question of whether ghosts actually exist or not and, you know, thrown it aside.
I think you have to. So when you approach these, you have talked about this a little bit in the intro, but when you approach this as you're a sociologist, you're a skeptic, and you're approaching these, when you're listening to the stories, like, how are you capturing them, and are you trying to remain neutral while you listen, and then, like, you do your, like, critical evaluation later, or what's your approach there? Like, what is your note-taking like? Like, what's it like to be a sociologist researcher of this topic?
Oh, actually, I enjoy interviewing. You know, it's a very social thing. You know, you're sitting down with somebody, you turn on your tape recorder, which is out of an iPhone these days, and they're 100 times better than the old tape recorders. They'll pick up an elephant a mile away.
Or ghost material. What do they call that? It's not. I keep wanting to say EMF. That's not right. It's
EVPs.
Oh my God! Electronic voice phenomena. Woo!
Yeah, I mean, but anyway, so interview them, transcribe the interview as verbatim as possible, and then you start reading it and you start picking out what's interesting. And again, you know, you put the 38 interviews together in several hundred pages. It's a jigsaw puzzle. You know, it's almost like you're taking a pair of scissors and cutting out things and putting them in piles. And so then you found, you know, you've got like 18 incidences where people said that, and 24 incidences where people said that, only 2 where they said that. And then you sort of take it from there. Well, my approach to this is grounded theory. What that simply means is that you walk into the field with as few assumptions as you possibly can, and you build your theory inductively from the data. So I'm in that process right now, and so I guess that's why I'm, you know, not being terribly theoretical. I'm thinking right now, but. If you come and see me next year, maybe I'll be able to dazzle you. Who knows?
Well, yeah, we would love to. Yeah, we'd love some follow up on this. I think one of the things I've noticed is, you know, a lot of the people who do research into these sort of fringe topics are not formally trained researchers. They're amateur researchers with a lot of enthusiasm.
That's true. Like exactly.
But they don't. They sometimes do a filtering on the material. What I'm thinking about is there's been lots of times in cryptozoology where people are trying to get Bigfoot stories, and then the people reporting will say, oh, and also I saw a UFO, and they won't include that in their research. Or the UFO people say, and I saw a Bigfoot, and they won't – like just a small number of researchers like said, well, you know, there's some – if you actually listen to these people, there's some crossover material, and it wasn't really part of my research, but it's interesting, and if you collect it – it might say something. It might be important. I don't know. But there is a filtering going on as this stuff gets reported.
Or a bias. You know, not to speak very much about American politics, if you like, but, you know, there are certain news stations in the United States and certain reporters that will, you know, horribly, horribly bias, you know, reality. People will listen to this news station and, you know, they'll think about it. But the very same way, you know, if you go out to prove the existence of ghosts and, you know, and talk to people, well, you know, you can't draw your conclusions before you do your research. That's like the prime directive in any of the social sciences, you know. Your conclusions come after the research, not before. I'll leave American politics out of it.
So with your research, have you come up with any statistics for how common belief is? And, you know, I guess we could break that down too. How many people have, what percentage of people have seen a ghost, or what percentage of people believe in the paranormal in general? Do you have any, did you develop any statistics on that?
I wish I had that information. Yeah, there are no studies that I know of in Canada that have been general surveys. I can't tell you. I mean, there's several studies in the United States, just have them written down here. I mean, there's the Chapman University survey, for example, and they say that 58% of Americans believe that a place can be haunted. There's also a Pew Research Center poll that says 18% of Americans believe they have been in the presence of a ghost. So, you know, I mean, Canada, I think, would be probably quite similar because there are similarities in the culture. But, you know, so I think we can go with 18%, you know, given the data, 18, 20%.
So yeah. I think I've studies that say anything from around that figure through to maybe 75%. And I guess it depends on the study and the time, but I would think that it would be higher than 18%. A lot of people certainly in the general public seem to believe in ghosts and the supernatural.
Well, don't forget, this is 18% believe they've been in the presence of a ghost.
Right.
And the whole bunch of people haven't had that opportunity yet, so to speak. But Chapman University puts it at 58%.
It's because all these other guys are hoarding all the ghosts. That's what's going on.
Yeah, 338.
Yes, exactly. You know, in thinking, it's very, very comforting to believe in the existence of ghosts, I would think, because, you know, all of your loved ones are going to be there. It would be very comforting to believe in heaven, because when you die, you know, you're going to see everybody that you love. And presumably not everybody that you didn't get along with in life, kind of thing. So it's almost envious, I almost have envy of people who do firmly have these beliefs. Because they can be comforting, but at the same time, they can be terrifying, particularly if you feel that you have a malevolent ghost around you. And I've had a couple of cases of that, you know, ghost that, you know, is there in the house and refuses to leave, you know, and they call in a spiritual leader, an indigenous spiritual leader, or they call in a priest to bless the house, you know, and no, the damn ghost is still there, you know, won't leave.
I'm sure there's lots of ways to slice this up, but I can't help but think about it in terms of people who see hauntings as a sort of place and time sort of thing, where, you know, you have recurring phantasms, and then the people who see them as grief, you know, like grief specters.
Yeah.
And then the third being the people who see them as, this is sort of a spectrum, but from spirituality and spiritualism to New Age, that sort of ghosts as a proof of that mainstream religion got it wrong, and I think they're different ways of looking at things. I mean, one's almost like a weird phenomena that might not even be a consciousness, and then the other one seems like a message from the other side, and the third one is all over the place. So I'm really interested to see how you carve this up in your work.
So am I, actually. Yes, I mean,
a lot of work to do.
Okay, we make as few assumptions as possible. You build up from the data. And,
yeah.
If I were to sort of characterize that in building a house, I might have the frame up at this point, or perhaps the foundation laid.
Yeah.
But there's no walls up yet.
Gotcha. We know there's been a tremendous amount of research in this field from lots of different angles. So I'll be really interested to see where you go to get your influences on your study. This will be really cool. So I like the idea our listeners are getting a sort of front side peek at where your efforts are going.
Mm-hmm. So we were interested to find out what other research work has influenced your study.
Surprisingly, from a sociological point of view, there's very, very little research on actual, you know, ghost beliefs, if you like. Psychology has quite a few research on paranormal phenomena, if you like. But in sociology, it seems to be, you know, only like a handful of people. I've started reading books, but it's very hard to find a legitimate book actually on, you know, on ghost beliefs. A lot of it, you know, if you go to a bookstore, it's like Famous Ghosts of Canada or something like that, you know, and chapter's a different ghost.
Just stories and no analysis.
Exactly. And they sell. They sell quite a bit.
Yep, that's what's out there.
Well, we could definitely throw you some things that we found helpful if you're interested. So.
Oh, absolutely. If you can email them to me, I'd I'll go out and I'll get them on.
Yeah, and I think in general that it's from the area of psychology. People like Richard Wiseman.
Yes.
Yeah, there's a lot going. Like, there's the there's understanding ghosts from a experiencer's perspective, from a cultural perspective, from a, you know, how can I protect myself? There's all kinds of ways of looking at it.
And then a skeptical perspective, people like Joe Nickell too.
Yeah, absolutely. So, we've got lots of references. And us. Yeah, in 10 years of Monster Talk. So, yeah.
And there are a number of macro theories within sociology. For example, phenomenology, which talks about the paramount reality versus finite provinces of meaning. In other words, the reality we live in versus sub realities that other people live in.
Oh, and religious studies has done a lot of work on this too. Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah.
Yeah. I don't want to leave anybody out because we've talked to so many academics working in this field. But yeah, we'd be glad to throw stuff your way, and we look forward to seeing what you're able to produce. This would be really cool.
Sure.
Well, it's been wonderful talking to you both.
All right. Well, we are at the end of our time. All right, David Aveline.
Yes, sir.
What is your favorite monster?
I've almost forgotten about that. I like Spooky and Casper. Do you know the reference?
Spooky and Casper. I know Casper the Friendly
Ghost.
Casper
the Ghost, yeah.
Casper the Friendly Ghost, but at the same time, there's Spooky, who was sort of a street smart ghost. And when I was 10, 11, 12 years old, I used to buy these comics all the time. But they always stuck with me. But I don't think they have them anymore. But the Spooky comics.
Is this Spooky the Tough Little Ghost?
Yeah, with the bowl hat on and the cigar.
Yeah, no, I don't know this. It looks vaguely familiar.
I don't know this.
But it was part of the new Casper cartoon show from 1963 to 69. So I guess I did see it.
Wow.
Oh, okay. Wow, you know the stuff. Exactly.
The smoking ghost.
That is really, That I'm sure he's cleaned up his act now. So.
Yeah.
Then I like the rock monster and Neverending Story.
Oh yeah, that's a good one too. Yeah.
Yeah, exactly.
Some different answers.
Yes.
He is really cool. Yeah, that's such an influential film. I don't know if you watched the TV show or the Netflix show Stranger Things, but in the most recent season they had that show, the movie sort of made an appearance. It was really fun for people my age.
That was the 80s.
Yeah, it was. So yeah, that a very fun nostalgia trip there. So it'd be a good place to throw in that music. Okay, well, we are going to wind up. David, thank you so much for talking.
Thank you so much. That was really interesting. We look forward to finding out the results of your research. We'll have to have you back on again.
Monster Talk.
You've been listening to Monster Talk, the science show about monsters. I'm Blake Smith.
And I'm Karen Stolzner.
You've been listening to an interview with Dr. David Aveline of the Mount Royal University in Canada, describing the early stages of his sociological research into ghosts and people who experience them. We hope to hear more about how his research turns out in the future. We hope you've enjoyed this episode of Monster Talk. Each episode, we strive to bring you the very best in monster-related content with a focus on bringing scientific skepticism into the conversation. If you enjoy Monster Talk, we now have a variety of ways to support the show, all with convenient links at monstertalk.org/support. That's monstertalk.org/support. We have links there to our Patreon page as well as a donation button. Another great way to support the show is to buy books from our Amazon Monster Talk wish list, which directly helps us with our research. We love used books very much, so don't feel compelled to buy new ones. And we love Kindle, so we can share our digital libraries with each other. And finally, without spending any money at all, you can support us by leaving a positive review at iTunes or wherever you get your podcasts. Positive reviews help keep us visible in iTunes, which is a great way to help us find new listeners. And please share our show on your favorite social media platforms. Check out our Monster Talk merchandise at monstertalk.org/store, where you can find a variety of cool products to show that you're a next level monster enthusiast. Monster Talk theme music's by Pete Stealing Monkeys. And thank you again for making time for our show in your busy life.
Been a Monster House presentation.